From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And this is Studs Terkel, and it's a book I've written. It's come about through years, osmosis or something. Seeing movies and plays ever since I was 10 years old. Of course, my folks had a little hotel near the Loop, Chicago's theatrical area, and I'd see stuff for nothing. And I suppose much of my life was based on fantasies derived from watching movies.
When Studs Terkel listens, everybody talks. Okay, it's not my quote, but it's a very good one. And we'll take a look at the World Trade Organization deal that was struck between China and the United States. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UN ambassadors yesterday welcomed the tentative deal for the United States to pay the United Nations nearly $1 billion in back dues, but complained it wasn't enough and that the agreement contained troublesome conditions. The House and Senate have yet to vote on the payment. The United States is the biggest debtor to the United Nations. It must pay $350 million by December 31st to keep its seat in the UN General Assembly. The administration and Congress reached the deal Sunday night after Clinton yielded on conservatives' demands for limits on some U.S. subsidized abortion activities overseas. In exchange, close to $1 billion will be provided to pay the U.S. dues. The breakthrough U.S.-China trade deal signed yesterday creates numerous winners and losers as it pushes China's protected state-dominated economy toward a, quote, freer market. Some of the big winners include foreign banks, insurers, and service companies that get wider access to China's 1.2 billion consumers. Elite Chinese companies will get cheaper foreign technology and surer access to export markets. Other winners include China's small but fast-growing computer and high-tech firms, which will see tariffs on imported technology drop. Casualties of the deal could include China's farms, which employ hundreds of millions of people, and state-owned banks, which could find themselves beaten out by sophisticated foreign competitors, will be allowed to conduct business in local currency. Meanwhile, a group of unarmed protesters broke into the World Trade Organization's lakeside headquarters in Geneva to protest against what they see as a WTO threat to people's livelihoods. Shouting death to the WTO, a dozen young men rushed past security guards and forced their way into the main lobby of the WTO headquarters minutes before U.S. Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman was due to hold a news conference. The protesters chained themselves to the main staircase inside the WTO building just outside the main council hall where Glickman was holding talks with WTO officials. The Reverend Jesse Jackson vowed to force a confrontation after school officials in Decatur, Illinois, refused to reconsider the expulsions of six students involved in a brawl at a football game. At a church rally that drew about 400 people last night, nearly everyone, including the students involved, stood when Jackson asked who was willing to be arrested at Eisenhower High School. Jackson threatened to cross police lines today if the school board doesn't agree to let the students return to regular school in January, providing they maintain good grades and behavior in alternative school. Family members of Martin Luther King Jr. hope a trial stemming from a lawsuit they filed will bring out new details about the civil rights leader's assassination. The family filed a wrongful death lawsuit last year against Lloyd Jowers, who claimed on national television in 1993 that he hired King's killer, and it wasn't James Earl Ray. Jowers has since refused to discuss his claim. A jury was selected to hear the case yesterday. Jowers has told the Kings the fatal shot actually was fired from a brushy area behind the restaurant, and the shooter handed him the rifle moments after the assassination. Jowers claims he gave the rifle to an unidentified conspirator the next day. He says he was paid $100,000 to hire the killer, whom he refused to identify, as a favor to a now-deceased man who allegedly had links to organized crime. A lieutenant in the Army Reserve, who is also a Republican member of the Arizona State Legislature, is facing disciplinary action stemming from the military's policy on gay men and lesbians. The Army began investigating Steve May after he admitted during a legislative debate that he was gay, in apparent violation of the Army's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. This news from San Francisco. The banks have won a round in what's shaping up as a lengthy legal fight over ATM fees. A U.S. District Judge yesterday granted a preliminary injunction to Wells Fargo and Bank of America, which sued to block enforcement of bans on certain ATM fees in Santa Monica and San Francisco. This news from Florida. Voters upset over Governor Jeb Bush's executive order wiping out racial preferences in Florida's universities and contracting decisions are being urged to strike back at his brother. Congressmember Corinne Brown said minority voters should not just retaliate against the Florida governor on Election Day, but also at Republican presidential frontrunner Jeb Bush. She said his brother is running and we're going to deal with his brother.
So wrong, I'm so sad, yeah, so wrong, I heard they ran you out of Harlem, I feel so sad, so bad, yeah, I heard you pleading for men.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. U.S. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky said today she's confident Congress will back an agreement struck yesterday between the Clinton administration and China that paves the way for China's entry into the World Trade Organization. Under the agreement reached after 6 days of negotiations, Beijing will reduce tariffs on various industrial and agricultural products and lift trade barriers to allow foreign companies to operate in China. In exchange, the U.S. agreed to support China's bid for membership in the WTO, the 135-member organization that sets the rules for international commerce. Opponents of China's entry into the World Trade Organization criticized the Clinton administration for ignoring China's record of human rights and labor rights violations and say they fear that they'll lose one of the only bargaining chips that could be used to force Beijing to comply with international human rights standards. The agreement comes just 2 weeks before foreign ministers from the WTO member nations are to meet in Seattle to establish rules on free trade. They'll be met by tens of thousands of protesters from labor, human rights, environmental and other organizations that are converging on Seattle to protest the WTO's exclusion of fundamental human rights from its trade agenda. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from Seattle live for the week. Right now, though, we're joined by Lori Wallach. She's director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch and speaks to us from Washington about this historic accord. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lori Wallach.
Good morning.
What is your assessment of the deal that has been hammered out by the U.S. and China? Apparently, U.S. trade representative set to go home a number of times over the last week or a few days that she's been in China. But ultimately, they did work out this deal.
Well, I guess I would like to quote the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, who said it's disgustingly hypocritical for, and that's a quote, for the Clinton administration to talk about putting a human face on the global economy and then to make a deal such as this. This deal has even been criticized today in a Washington Post editorial because as a commercial matter, the probability that China follows the agreement is slight based on China's record in the past. But then in addition, as you said, the U.S. in making this deal cedes what leverage it has over China regarding human rights, weapons proliferation, et cetera. As the Washington Post editorial this morning points out, in one room, the U.S. trade representative was making the U.S. corporations happy by signing this deal, while several blocks away, practicers of Falun Gong were being jailed for 20 years for silent meditation.
You talk about John Sweeney talking about this as disgustingly hypocritical, and yet John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, has just endorsed the WTO global trade talks that are set for Seattle.
There's been a huge controversy over what exactly he endorsed. The AFL-CIO's releases and statements say he endorsed formation of a working group on labor rights, and in order to get businesses to support that, signed on to a broader statement. Whatever the outcome is for that particular incident, what is clear and what is very stark is the tone of the AFL-CIO statement about this deal. And to the extent the AFL-CIO was perhaps trying to work with the administration to fix the WTO, all over Capitol Hill now people are saying, well, if that organization, the WTO, is ever vaguely fixable, if you put China into the organization, the WTO is not going to make China follow a rule of law. China is going to make the WTO totally unreformable.
We're talking to Lori Wallach, who's head of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, one of the leaders of the movement against the WTO talks set for Seattle, and one of the leading spokespeople around the issue of globalization against corporate globalization. At the top of the show, Lori, I talked about the trade deal, the winners and the losers. Can you say what this deal actually does? Who does benefit? Who doesn't?
Well, it's hard to say because literally, practically, the history of China actually following any of its international commitments is extremely bleak. And that goes from commercial agreements to human rights and non-proliferation agreements. There was an interesting story today in the New York Times that had a business person saying, when the deal is signed, that's when the real negotiations start. So it's really unclear what we got. What was done, the reason this was done, is because President Clinton is enormously eager to claim some sort of legacy about trade, and on paper this is a great coup. If China were to follow all of the terms that are supposed to be in the agreement, which of course no one has seen, so we have to go on the summaries that the Clinton administration has put forward in a way as their spin, the goal of the agreement would be to get China over the next 5 years to open up its markets to imported farm products from the U.S. and to open up its insurance and telecommunications and finance and investment and banking sectors. And the upsides from corporate America's perspective would be the ability to control those sectors in a country with a billion and a half people. The downside, both for people in China and in the U.S., most people, is in China, in 5 years' time, you're going to try and transform an entire economy basically by kicking it in the pants headfirst into the global economy. The New York Times and mainstream newspapers report that literally hundreds of millions of people in China will be unemployed by this sudden change, with potential political and other instability resulting. In the U.S., the hitch is that what the U.S. has signed on to is an agreement that's only about commerce. So, for instance, the senior Democrat in the House, Mr. Gephardt, said that to have a successful deal with China about WTO, you need to get the commercial part right. You need to figure out some way to enforce it, because China always breaks its deals, so something other than just the normal WTO enforcement. And you need to figure out a way to deal with labor rights and human rights. And this agreement, which is being touted as a great success, just got the commercial commitments, what the businesses wanted, down on paper. It doesn't have an enforcement mechanism, and it totally ignores the human rights and labor rights issues. So the prospects for U.S. workers are, for the companies in this country who want an educated, incredibly cheap, and literally militarily suppressed labor force, you can go to China, make stuff, and have guaranteed access back into the U.S. with no potential conditions.
Now, Congress doesn't vote on the agreement itself, is that right? But on whether the U.S. should permanently grant China normal trading privileges.
And that's going to be the mother of all trade battles.
What does that mean? What does it mean to grant them normal trading privileges?
Right now, the way it works, China's status on trade with the U.S. needs to be reviewed every year. And there are historical reasons for that, not the least of which was China has never convinced Congress that it would follow up to its trade obligations. So Congress has never given China permanent most favored nation status. That is what, for instance, typically countries in the GATT get. And what it means is the U.S. gives its most preferential trade and investment and regulatory benefits to another country and is supposed to get them back reciprocally, and that that's not subject to review or removal. To get permanent MFN for China would mean an end to the annual reviews on human rights and labor rights. It literally would take away whatever limited leverage the U.S. has in those issues. But the reason it's going to be an enormous battle is that, as, for instance, the recent Zogby poll showed, three-fourths of Americans, Democrats, Republicans across the country, different income levels, different ages, think that the U.S. already is too cozy with China on trade, to the risk of other incredibly important values like democracy, human rights, religious freedom. So Congress, and this fight's going to be in the House of Representatives, is going to have to agree against the interests and will of three-fourths of the American public, against what is going to be an enormous campaign of labor, consumer, environmental, religious, human rights groups, as well as Chinese dissident groups, the activists who are people who, for instance, got out of China after Tiananmen Square and operate the Democracy in China campaign, are vehemently against China getting this incredible political plum, this legitimacy for this dictatorship of entry into the WTO. So all of those groups will be fighting tooth and nail against what is going to be a very well-heeled corporate coalition that intends, as they put it, to make their NAFTA campaign look like nothing in comparison to what they'll do to try and push Congress to give China this plum.
Lori Wallach, I wanted to ask you about two stories in the news today and how they relate to the World Trade Organization. One is a fresh lawsuit has been filed against Union Carbide, the chemical company involved in the world's worst industrial disaster. 7,000 people died in 84 after the deadly gas leak from the company's pesticide plant in Bhopal, India. And the other story is about how New York, for the first time, has sued the General Electric company over PCB contamination in the Hudson River. And the Attorney General of New York said he hopes more lawsuits would follow. Now, some, can see the relation between these two polluting companies and lawsuits against them. Could you say what would happen under global trade pacts? Would these kind of lawsuits be affected?
Well, the agenda the Clinton administration has to expand the World Trade Organization, as if it weren't bad enough, at the Seattle summit coming up in 2 weeks, includes a proposal by Japan and Europe to put in some of the provisions of NAFTA that aren't in the WTO, and those have to do with investment rules, i.e. how you can regulate or how you can hold accountable companies investing or operating in your territory, which would get to the PCB issue. In fact, right now there's a series of NAFTA lawsuits where corporations are suing governments for cash damages for regulations, zoning rules, keeping toxic waste sites out of watersheds, etc., that undermine their profitability. So the shift in relative rights and powers between corporations and government is a key issue in these trade agreements, and one of the agendas of expanding the WTO is to give more powers to corporations to actually sue governments for damages when governments set rules, and in fact to limit the ability of governments to hold corporations accountable.
Lori Wallach, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask you a question about Cuba and the trade embargo and if there isn't a double standard. This is the Ibero-American Summit is taking place, historic event in Havana, Cuba. And then when we finish with you, we are joined by Studs Terkel in the studio, the great oral historian of this century. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we finish up our conversation with Lori Wallach, Lori Wallach is one of the leaders of the Global Trade Watch movement. She is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. And as tens of thousands of protesters plan to go to Seattle the week after Thanksgiving to protest the WTO global trade talks, she is one of those who has spent the last year and more building this movement. Today, we're talking about the major headline-grabbing story, the China-U.S. trade deal that was struck yesterday. Not clear exactly what it is. Lori Wallach responding to that. We have that deal worked out, Lori. And at the same time, there's Cuba, which has just sued the United States for its trade embargo against the island for the last, well, close to 40 years.
What's an interesting juxtaposition, I guess, is the U.S. making a sweetheart deal with China, a country that has the highest execution rate by percentage of population in the world, a country that crushes the beginnings of any democratic movement, any attempt to organize a labor union, for that matter, crushes the religious movement, the main gist of which is quiet meditation and yoga. And that, in contrast, making a sweetheart deal with that government, basically giving them what they have sought for the last 10 years, global legitimacy for that sort of conduct towards their people, in contrast to how the United States behaves towards Cuba, which it makes out to be the most dangerous, threatening crusher of human rights, which the legitimacy of that argument is very much undermined by the U.S. cozying up to China while continuing to cut off Cuba.
Any last comments on this day after the U.S.-China trade pact, when we see the big debate that is shaping up in Congress and the House of Representatives, Republicans now dividing amongst each other as well, not to mention with Democrats over the trade deal, where you're putting your efforts right now, how you're focusing?
Well, the proponents of the deal are trying to play a game of psych out, where they're saying, oh, piece of cake, we'll get this right away, no problem. And this is a strategy to try and create a mood of inevitability. And it's total baloney. And they know it, because they know the same numbers that we know, which is that if people around the country contact their member of the House of Representatives, that's where this fight's going to be, and make it clear to them, you want to make this deal, you are going to be the next person who loses a job, because an election is coming up in a year, and we're going to hold you accountable for selling out human rights, freedom of speech, labor rights. If, in fact, we all get going, the psych-out campaign is going to go up in a puff of smoke. Because, in fact, we actually have a slight gain on the guys who want to ram this deal through Congress. And as long as we all make clear to our members of Congress that the corporations, who might offer them a lot of money, cannot buy them back our votes if they roll us and we tell them, forget it, you're out of here. So that kind of communication is now necessary because there is going to be a huge corporate pile-on. It's starting now, today. The limo line outside Congress will be endless, and we need to make sure that we lock down our votes, and we'll stop this deal.
Are you headed to Capitol Hill today?
You know it, right as soon as I get off the phone.
Well, Lori Wallach, we won't hold you back. Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue with our program today. Yes, when Studs Terkel listens, everybody talks. Well, I got this from a recent review of Studs Terkel's new book. Believe it or not, folks, he is not stopping. It's called The Spectator, and the review is by John Leonard in The Nation, quoting the late broadcaster Charles Kuralt. For 45 years, Studs Terkel, broadcaster and author, spent an hour each weekday on his nationally syndicated radio show, talking with famous and not-so-famous guests and with his loyal audience of Chicago listeners. He has a unique style, to say the least, of oral history on subjects like race, war, employment. He spent decades interviewing Americans across the country, creating intimate portraits of everyday life and chronicling changing times through this century. Studs Terkel's work is particularly significant now as we move into a new century as a chronicle of the last century. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!, Studs.
Thank you very much, Amy.
It's great to have you here. Gosh, I don't know where to begin because you just embody everything, to say the least. Not only all of the people that you've been listening to for so long, but also a new approach that you've got in the first of a trilogy of books that you're writing and has just come out, this one called The Spectator. Talk about movies and plays with those who make them, because I'm not used to seeing you talk to the famous, and here you are.
Well, this is a continuation, you might say. It's a way, a strange continuation, a sequel to Working. Remember, I'm known for having spoken to the anonymous people. You know, the irony is, I'm celebrated for having celebrated the non-celebrated, the anonymous ones who, so-called ordinary people who are capable of extraordinary things. In this case, through 45 years with this station in Chicago, WFMT, I'm now with the Chicago Historical Society trying to save those tapes. But I've interviewed all variety of people, whether it be Bertrand Russell, North Wales during the Cuban Missile Crisis, or South Africa during apartheid days with Chief Albert John Luthuli, the predecessor of Nelson Mandela, who was still in prison. But meantime, interviewing people who were celebrated, not celebrities, but celebrated for their work and their skill. Buster Keaton in silent films, Marlon Brando in plays and theater, Zero Mostel, whether it be a painter or a wild comic who's on stage even when he's off stage, Carol Channing brilliantly analyzing Lorelei Lee, the playgirl of the jazz age, and showing how sharp she is. And so in a sense, it's continuation. They're talking about their skills, their work. The only trouble I had was Brando when he turned tables and tried to interview me, and that became something of a duel of sorts.
Well, you were an actor yourself, weren't you?
What's that?
You were an actor yourself.
Well, I was a ham-bone actor, and one of the reasons I like this book so much, and Gary Wills does introductions, and it's my best book. That's his opinion. But it's because I was in a play once, Summer Stock, with Buster Keaton, long after his silent film days are over. You know, during Summer Stock, actors would need a buck or two, a play on something. It was a play called Three Men on a Horse, and it was not the role for him. You know, it's about three men, three touts, kidnap a timid card-writing greeting salesman because he's clairvoyant and picking out winners. And I'm one of the three racetrack touts that kidnap him. The play wasn't much, but there was a scene he put in. I'm on the wings watching him. This is 1949 in the Summer Stock Company. I was watching this master invent a scene, nothing new with the play. He's caught with a bedsheet, and that bedsheet sort of puzzles him. He can't get out of it. Suddenly, he becomes a Roman toga. And he's a senator, you know, with that deadpan looking at. And he can't get out of it. Suddenly, he's a sheik. He becomes a Valentino, you know. And suddenly, he becomes a white shroud. And I said, what would W.C. Fields do with this? W.C. Fields would destroy the thing. He'd kick it. Chaplin would embrace it and dance with it. Ballet. And so, in a sense, that's how it begins. My own fantasies, how my day begins. After a hard day's night, I wake up and I see the sun through the window. It's a cold sun and the leaves are trembling. It's the opening of Rashomon. You see, it's Kurosawa's son. There's a guy, the wood chopper is going through, people I assume have seen this movie. He's going through the woods and he sees a woman's hat in one bush, a man's robe another, a rope another. Something terrible has happened. Something terrible has happened. I've overslept, you see. I've had Benadryl, and next thing you know, I hear a voice, and it says, rise and shine. But it's Lorette Taylor's voice. It's Amanda in Glass Menagerie. See, but finally, here's the payoff, one of the things. I had a quintuple bypass about several years ago, so I used dumbbells as part of the rehab, and the dumbbell was lying carelessly on my way to the bathroom. I trip over the dumbbell, and I spray my neck, so I wear a neck brace. So I look in the mirror, and I'm Erich von Stroheim in Grand Illusion, you know, hollering out, if you remember the great, that marvelous anti-war movie in which he's the commandant, German commandant of French officers who are prisoners. He admires the other officer because they're both members of the same class. But this other officer, Captain Bollier, is helping two other guys escape. And I don't want to shoot him. He's my friend, a fellow aristocrat. So I holler in the mirror. It's me hollering, come down, I beg of you, Captain Bollier. And you hear my voice, a voice of my wife says, you come down, breakfast's getting cold. See, so that's how my day begins. So I'm also fantasizing at the same time interviewing these various people about their skills and their craft. So I find it, for me, it was exciting.
I have to say, Studs, you're really looking terrific because the last time I saw you was at the Democratic Convention a few years ago, and you weren't looking as young as you are right now. You're 87?
87, yeah. I was born in 1912. The Titanic went down, and I came up. But then Jimmy Carter said, who said life was fair? So there you have it. You see, my publisher's name was Andre Schifrin, the New Press, and when I did this, Studs, I said, well, that's about it, Andre, this book. He said, oh, no. See, this is, you're interviewing people of the theater. You've interviewed, leader singers? Let's say, Laura Lehmann, the great leader singer of our century, her farewell concert, or John Jacob Niles, or Gene Ritchie, or Dizzy Gillespie, or Little Heart and Armstrong. That's called the listener, see, music. I said, well, that's interesting. I'll be 91 to, yeah, and then there's a third. Oh, there is. You have to read writers and poets, you know. That's called the reader. Well, Andre, then I'll be about 101. He says, and then what do I do? Then we'll talk about it further, he says. So that's the nature
of it. It does have to be a quartet. The trilogy The book is The Spectator, where Studs Terkel interviews all sorts of performers, like Marcel Marceau.
Marcel Marceau, the mime. As John Leonard says, it's the forthcoming review in The Nation. John says, hard to stop him from talking. He just talked and talked. He shows, and it's quite marvelous talk. I interviewed him several times, once in Paris and once there. And he's analyzing the role of the mime through history and also the very nature of life itself as he does the mask maker. He does others. And he says a mime cannot lie. See, words can lie, but a mime can't lie. The gesture speaks. And so that's the challenge that he faces and meets. And that's just one of them. In contrast, Zero Mostel is always on stage. So I have to go along with him as a straight man sometimes, see. You know, Zero Mostel he's a brilliant scholar when it comes to painting, to art, to literature, to theater. This clown is really a clown in the greatest sense of the word. Sometimes, but he's always on. Suddenly he puts on an Italian dialect. So I go along with him. I remember a routine he once did with Philip Loeb, a very great friend of his. So I decided I'd be his straight man. So he says, and so does a man. And I say, Signor Mostelli, since he starts speaking Italian, you are the world's greatest tenor. You just come off the boat. You know, this is pre-airplane days. He says, see, I'm Signor Mostelli. I said, you are the greatest since Caruso. Caruso, I said, Now, it's known that Italian tenors are known for their feuds. They hate tenors, other tenors. So I said, what is your opinion of, we're so delighted you're here as our guest, the eminent Signor Morselli. What is your opinion, say, of Luciano Pavarotti? Papaducci is a pig, you know. What do you think of Franco Corelli? He's a pig. What do you think of Giuseppe Di Stefano? Oh, he's the three biggest the pig of all. What do you think of Tito Gobbi? He's a baritone. I said, well, Signor Morselli, I represent the Musical Courier. It's the Bible of the opera world. It's our 75th anniversary. Everyone's taken ads from Caruso to Callas to Martinelli. No ads, please. Everybody knows Signor Morselli. Well, one of our correspondents heard you as Radames Naida at La Scala last week, and he thought you were awfully sharp. He says, I'll take a 10 pages. And so that's the way I have to adjust to him. Or I'm adjust to others in different ways. So it works out rather interesting challenge for me.
You have been chronicling our world for so many years. There is a very moving quote by Marcel Marceau that John Leonard picks up in this upcoming review. And I wanted to ask what you think about it relating to your own life. He says, there's something of Pirandello in what I do, that we're not one man, but we're many. We have not one face, but many. We change. It's inevitable. He says, I'm very happy to grow a little older. I was just 37 this month. People say the more you grow in age, the more you lose possibilities. I would say it's the contrary, that the great drama for human, that's the great drama for human people. The more you grow in age, the more you grow in spirit and in your experiences, but the less you grow in your physical possibilities.
Oh, well, you're raising the challenge of the ages. In a forthcoming book, the listener, Laura Lehmann, the great leader singer of our century, it was in her 80s, and talking, she says, once she spoke to Bruno Walter, the great conductor, or Toscanini, they spoke of this very thing. How much knowledge they have as they grow older, the wisdom, the maturity, and yet physically they can't. And so they say, this is the eternal dilemma, and you face it, do the best you can. That's the dilemma. It's all that, if only you had the same, retain the vitality with the wisdom you've accumulated, wow, everything would be solved.
We'd end war.
What's that?
We might end war, because if you maintain that strength, but yeah. You had the wisdom.
If you what?
If you maintain that strength, but you had the wisdom.
Oh, well, then something is great happening. I know advances have been made in the whole world of medicine and geriatrics and all else. And our lifespan is increasing, and yet our society, not our own, all societies are such that the older you get, the more redundant you become. And today, guys are being canned for the 50 years old. So we have a goofy kind of setup, don't we?
Studs, you came to New York for a Nelson Algren event last night. Nelson Algren, and there's just been a 50th anniversary critical edition of his book, The Man with the Golden Arm, published. Now, a lot of people are probably saying, who's Nelson Algren?
Nelson Algren, well, to me, of course, is one of the most perceptive novelists, poetic, too, in a sense, of our half century, of the last half century, ever since World War II. Ma'am, it's the 50th anniversary of the book awards. But he won the very first one with Man with the Golden Arm. He was so prescient in his understanding of things. That's about someone who was hung up on drugs, you know. But he saw that way back. More than that, Nelson represented the have-nots in his own way, poetically, lyrically. And he always wondered why it is that girl is picked up for a $5 trick, but a guy pulls a $1 million trick, he's honored. He's called a CEO. So this is the thing. Nelson is the one who always said that it's the curious responsibility of the writer of all ages to get that judge on the dock, get that judge on the bench, and bring him down into the dock. And he says, and he wrote this beautiful poem, exquisite poem, back to Chicago called City on the Make. And during a Black Sox baseball scandal in 1919, 8 guys were kicked out of baseball, but the owners were not. And he says, how come the front office men never conspire? How come the senator is always so close to God? But he always questions that. And he's quite remarkable in this. But it's also, he's also a clown. He's a great clown figure. And he's the clown who speaks truth to power. Always that, too.
he had trouble during the McCarthy era.
Oh, he did, sure. In fact, aside from the political troubles he had, he was hard to handle by the so-called self-proclaimed literary mandarins of New York. They didn't know how to handle him. They were scared of him, really. Because he was uncontrolled. He was himself. And so they made him a non-person. They declared him a non-person, pretty much. He's even beyond politics. It's a guy they couldn't handle.
But why during the McCarthy era was he?
Oh, well, he spoke out, you know, on various matters. And when you speak out, you're clobbered. Mm-hmm. And the ironic thing is book preceding Man with the Golden Arm, Never Come Morning, is the one that Sartre and de Beauvoir liked so much in Paris. And, of course, she fell in love with him. And that's a funny story. So I knew them.
Save that story, because we have to break for stations to identify themselves.
Okay.
But we come back, Simone de Beauvoir and Nelson Algren. And I guess he couldn't go see her in France because losing his passport during the McCarthy era. They withheld it, the U.S. government. Studs Terkel is our guest, the oral historian of this century, and he's still got another book out. Working, Working, Working. No, that's not the title of it. His new book is The Spectator. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Studs Terkel in the studio. Studs, you were just talking about the writer Nelson Algren.
Well, that was a remarkable romance of Simone de Beauvoir and Nelson Algren. You know, he should tell a lot of jokes, you know, in American idioms, and she didn't understand, but she laughed at all the jokes, didn't it? So then I knew she was in love with him. But what an unlikely combination they were. So I was in Paris at a certain time during the Algerian crisis, when she and Sartre were in danger, really were, from the OAS, the fascist group with the plastic bombs, remember that? And so, but they're in the news. Le Monde, Figaro carry this romance on front pages of the American writer from Chicago and de Beauvoir. And so I'm Nelson's close friend, so the three of us go to this restaurant where she's known, one of these posh, you know, restaurants, old one, about 70 years, 100 years old. They all know her. And the upper bourgeoisie are there, and they're all looking at this couple. I'm with them. I'm almost like in Zorba the Greek, you know, Alan Bates and Tony Quinn and Lila Kedrova, almost in that same. So I'm like Alan Bates, and the three are there, and you see people looking. Nelson is a clown. He has what seems to be a diamond, a stick pin in his tie, but it's a little electric light bulb, and he has a battery in his pocket. And so when these couples look up, that's so-and-so, he lights the bulb, and the bulb flashes, the people are startled. And she says, isn't he wonderful? Isn't he wonderful? I said, yeah, well, he's a little crazy, you know, but nice. And so, but the romance was a genuine one, certainly on her part. He later on, it fell apart. But what attracted him and Sartre and their friend Jacques Bust, who translated Never Come Morning into French, is that there's something he caught that they felt is right in that book prior to Golden Arm and then on. And he was more or less their American hero for a time.
In The Spectator, in this book, the first of the trilogy, talking about movies and plays with the people who make them, you also take on James Baldwin. Did you know James Baldwin?
Oh, yes. When he first came back from And Nobody Knows My Name. And that was an exciting interview when he was speaking of the fact that Black people know all about white people. You know, they're there. They're the invisible men and women, to paraphrase Ralph Ellison's book. And so, he came back from Switzerland. He was there, and he heard of Bessie. See, I opened up, you know, I worked certain ways, and I knew how he is. So I opened up Bessie Smith singing Blackwater Blues, because that opens up the avenue. That's the music he played for that white snow of Switzerland to hear this blues. It was very exciting. As he talked, by the way, he also talks rather interesting. How blacks and whites see a movie, The Defiant Ones. Stan, remember that nice, sweet movie of the two convicts escaping, the black convict Sidney Poitier and the white convict Tony Curtis. And as the train is escaping, they're chained, and the white convict falls off the train, and the black convict runs off to help him escape. And then as the white audience would cheer, and black would say, "Get back to that train, you fool! Are you out of your mind or something?" That was very fascinating.
In fact, your first book, wasn't it about music and the history?
Oh, I did a book years ago for young people on jazz called Giants of Jazz, in which I go from King Oliver to John Coltrane, you know, and connect all their lives through Billie Holiday, through Basie, through stuff of that sort.
You and Mahalia Jackson had a thing going.
Well,
right?
Mahalia Jackson I was the white disc jockey. She always gave me credit. There's quite a story goes with us. She gave me credit for being the white disc jockey. I'd play one of her records called Move On Up a Little Higher way back in 1945 on Apollo 78 on a disc jockey show, rather eclectic program, opera and jazz and folk and all. And whites heard her for the first time, and so she gave me credit for that, though she'd have been known anyway. So I was her, the MC and the host of her network shows, and that's a story. I think I told it the other day, didn't I? I think I did. The blacklist. Well, you know, it's too long a tale. I was hot stuff back in 1950 when TV was new. TV was brand new. And it was down 6 to 10 at night. Chicago had three programs. It was not the sales medium it is. So Chicago had three. One called Cooper Fran Ollie with Bert Tilstrom, the puppeteer, who was brilliant. Little rags in his hands came alive, called Cooperpolitans. The second was Dave Garraway, a disc jockey like I was, who became very easy. He became the first host of the Today Show, the very first face ever seen on daytime TV. And the third show was mine, called Studs Place. These three were jazzy. They were improvised. It was live. There was no safety net, no canned laughter, of course not. And so all of us were hot. Mike Wallace went from Chicago to New York. Garraway did, and I was wooed. And then came the Cold War. And I signed all these petitions, you know. So a guy comes in from New York, says, "We're in trouble." So I said, "Well, where do you get that wee stuff, you know?" And he says, "Well, you're in all these petitions." I says, "Yeah, it's anti-Jim Crow, anti-poll tax." He says, "Don't you know that communists are behind these petitions?" And that's when I get cute. And I say, "Well, maybe so, but suppose communists came out against cancer. Do we come out for cancer?" And the guy says, "Not very funny." I said, "No, it wasn't." So it would go on in this vein. And finally he said, "Why don't you simply say you were duped, you know?" I said, "But I wasn't. I'm against the poll. I'm against Jim Crow." "So am I, but say you were duped because you're a valuable property." I said, but I wasn't. So to this day, people think that I was heroic. I was scared shitless, as a matter of fact. But my ego was at stake, my vanity, and that's what did it. And so then I'm canned. And then later on, I got on this FM station. So later on, I did Mahalia, and now I'm the host of her show on CBS. It's now about 5 years later. And sure enough, we're doing this. It's a live show. There's an audience comes in, you know. And before the audience comes in, this one show, it's for 26 weeks. In the third week, another guy from New York comes in. This time at CBS. Last time it was NBC. And he gives me something to sign. It's a loyalty oath. I said, "Well, I don't sign those things." And Mahalia's passing by. We're rehearsing, you know. She's going with Mildred Falls, her pianist, to rehearses, and she knew all about me. He said to me, "Stud, you got such a big mouth. You should have been a preacher, you know." And so she hears this conversation. I'm not going to sign. He said, "You got it?" I said, "No." She says, "Is that what I think it is, baby?" I says, "Yeah, and the loyalty oath." She says, "You going to sign it?" I says, "No." "Well, let's rehearse." He says, "Oh, but Miss Jackson, Miss Turkle has to do it in New York. He has to sign." "He doesn't have to do anything he doesn't want to do. He said he didn't want to do it, so let's rehearse." He says, "No." Now she says, "Look, if that Mr. Big says the fire studs, you tell him to get another Mahalia Jackson." You know what happened? Nothing happened. The guy disappeared. What's the moral? The moral is somebody said no. That whole period that Lillian Hellman called scoundrel time was craven time, was coward time. And someone said no. And that was the answer, simple as that. Nobody said no. So that's the story.
Studs Terkel telling us the story. Studs Terkel, the author of so many books, interviewer of people known and unknown throughout this century. What are you going to be doing on New Year's Eve as we move into a new century?
Well, strange enough, Chicago has a great millennium show. It's a marvelous jazz singer named Kurt Elling. He's arranging this whole thing. He's chosen part of Nelson Algren writings and part of it. So I'm going to do Nelson Algren stuff on this millennial program. So ordinary, I would not, but this is Algren, so I'm going to do it. So there'll be a Chicago history through various writers, I think.
Writers. Did you know Lorraine Hansberry?
Oh, very well. She's in this book. Lorraine Hansberry, I knew her from Chicago before she wrote Raisin in the Sun. And the interview took place just after the opening in Chicago. And she speaks of the Irish playwright, Sean O'Casey, being her great influence in poetry. She was young. She died young, you know. And she's from an old Chicago African-American family who've been scrappers, rather very well-off family who've been scrappers. And she became this playwright. It was about a year or two before she died.
How do you feel when you, who are such an astute observer, see the scoundrels rise and those with principle along the way have so much trouble? And then later, those people who rose compromising their principles being seen as the heroes.
Well, there was a great movie years ago called Fame is the Spur, a British film, about a great labor leader who sold out toward the end, based on a man named Ramsay MacDonald, a labor leader back in the 20s who became a lord and sold out. It's a marvelous movie, Michael Redgraven, and it's on this very theme. What it does, what power sometimes does. And that's one of those things that a rare political figure holds forth.
So did you know James Cagney?
Oh, no, I interviewed him, but I knew of him as a playgoer. Remember, I came from Chicago, and off in Chicago, boom, boom. And I blamed that whole Chicago's reputation in Public Enemy on James Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, and the Warner Brothers. And I two funny stories about that. The interview with him was rather fascinating. He's diffident and gentle, you know, the guy with the tough guys, but only it's about his work. But he's trying to explain his job. It's just the job I do. And he doesn't, how did you get that phrase, you know, what do you hear, what do you say? He speaks of a childhood. There was a friend of his who was going around with a hooker. He used that phrase, what do you hear, what do you say? He picks it up here and there. And but he was quite interesting, gentle, very gentle sort of guy. And I use hooks, little things. For example, I knew he likes prize fighting, and he did a painting of a prize fighter, and we talked about that, and that opened him up to talk about other things, because he was, and he's the one, you know, the great scene. For those who remember Public Enemy, never has a woman been smacked in the mouth with a grapefruit as he did when he smacked May Clark. See, in Public Enemy, he falls. He's living with a girl, May Clark, a gangster's girl, and she's whining because now he's in love with Jean Harlow, and so he's mad. So he's known for this famous scene when she shoves a grapefruit in her face, and people are all shocked. You know, no one treated her. He said, "Well, it was originally it was the scrambled eggs they had planned, but too messy, so the grapefruit didn't." Modeled after a Chicago gangster doing it, by the way, and because I knew about the Chicago gangster, so that led to a very interesting interview.
Studs Terkel, of all these interviews that you have in your latest book, The Spectator, talking about movies and plays with those who make them, what stood out for you the most? Who most?
There isn't one. Each one had a different approach. For example, Vittorio De Sica, Bicycle Thief. I saw him. This very handsome man was an actor in the movies, Vittorio De Sica. He'd be in junk movies to raise money so he could bust the... Even after Mussolini was hung by the heels, even after the war, neorealism, fascists were still in power, and he had a hard time. He had to subsidize his own films. And he was taken, and I said, the little boy, Bruno Ricci, in Bicycle Thief. You know the Bicycle Thief, the little boy? Bruno, he said, you know the name, you an American know the name. I said, Mr. De Sica, I saw the movie 12 times, you know. But they was taken with the fact that I knew the name of this. You an American know Bruno Ricci. But he would describe how he finds people. He used actual non-actors in it. and throughout his whole theme was that. Fellini, I asked Fellini, why did you choose Marcello Mastroianni as a gossip columnist? Why did you choose in contemporary Rome a gossip columnist? He says, isn't he the Herodotus of our day? Isn't the gossip columnist the Thucydides of our day? Isn't he our historian? It'd be very ironic. And so that's how the thing goes.
Well, we just have a few more minutes, but I have another question. And you survived your wife, didn't you?
I beg your pardon?
You survived your wife.
Survived my wife? No, she's okay.
Wait,
and the rumor, she'd be like Mark Twain. She says the rumor of my demise is slightly exaggerated.
I've done this a few times.
No, I don't. No, she's okay.
She's doing okay.
She's having a hard time, but she's okay.
Oh, okay. The Spectator, Studs' book, is just the first of the trilogy. You said you're going to be doing The Listener.
I said I'm going to be doing it. That doesn't mean I'm going to be doing it.
No, you committed to this.
I'm 87, see.
Studs, you committed to this. You said you're going to be doing The Listener, and you said you're going to be doing The Reader.
Yeah. Well, that's the dream of the publisher, Andre Schifrin. He has a dream.
It's more than his dream.
I have a dream, he said.
So what music are you going to be particularly focusing on in The Listener? You're going to be doing music.
Well, in The Listener, for example, I thought of this. I mentioned her name before. Lotta Lehmann is the great leader singer of our century. And she has a farewell concert. This is 30 years ago. And she was still in her prime. And she said, this is my last concert. And the audience, you hear the audience in town hall, her fans saying, no, you hear it on tape. She says, yes, I'll tell you why. I know. You don't know, but I know when I'm slipping in. Her great role was in an opera called Der Rosenkavalier. And she plays this royal woman, the Marshalin. Very beautiful, but still, she has a young lover, 17. And she sees the beginning intimation of a wrinkle in the great mirror scene. She gives up the young lover like that to the girl. So I've learned from her, she said. And so in a sense, this is something I've got to learn.
There was a piece on one of the networks about how people like Danny Glover, who was just in the studio a month or two ago, and Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins take advantage of their celebrity status to promote a cause. They don't talk about the people who take advantage for money and all that stuff, but to promote a cause, to promote the things they care about. What is your thought about that?
Well, I think anybody does believe in something to do it. I happen to admire Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins very much, but of course I
But
do.
The idea that they shouldn't be getting
political.
Oh, that's
political. Baloney. Yeah, they don't mind. They don't. You don't mind Charlton Heston promoting the National Rifle Association. Not much is made of that. Jeez, you know, don't mind Ronald Reagan promoting a cause, head of his own union, Screen Actors Guild, betraying, informing on his own members. As you know, had a code name as an FBI informant, you know. You know that, of course. Oh, common knowledge, sure. But that we don't mind, you see. There's a double standard, isn't there? But they come out, they're still, well, Simone Signoret in the book, by the way, speaks about that very theme. Isn't that funny? They want our opinions about all the goofiest things in the world, but when it comes to something like citizenship, they say, who are you to do it? And Signoret is in this, too, and she speaks of that very thing.
Any thoughts on the presidential race of the year 2000?
Well, I'm looking for a candidate. I don't know. It's let it ride, I think.
Barry Crimmins, a comedian who we were with last night at the William Kunstler Foundation Awards for Racial Justice, said the only tragedy in this race that's coming up is that one of them's going to win.
Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad. Yeah, there isn't much. I hope there is. I think it's up to, you know what, it's still the old story. I know the guy with the most dough wins, apparently. But the old story still, I think the idea of grassroots, a phrase hardly used, grassroots, door knocking, the old way. You're bucking, of course, a million to one shot, but it has to be. Something personal, person to person. A precinct captain is the most important person in the world in politics. It's a door to door. You meet a person, and that to me is what it's about. Even one vote.
Studs Terkel, thank you very much for hanging out with us today. Studs Terkel, the author and interviewer of A Century, his latest book is The Spectator, but it's not his last. And by the way, my regards to your wife. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. Special thanks to Robert Knight. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
for men who owns a paper mill.